This is the best of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis on Fox Sports Radio.
Let's dive into what happened in that Auburn game and all of the storylines that surrounded the end of the game between Auburn and Virginia. First of all, I thought the foul call was correct. I understand some people out there say, oh, the referee should swallow the whistle. I thought that the foul was correctly called in that scenario. Kyle Guy went up to shoot. He was going to have a pretty good look at the three-point shot for the win, and he got hit while the ball was still in his hand. And so, to me, that was different than the Tennessee-Purdue call, which I thought was very borderline, where you kick out your legs, and Carson Edwards at the end of Tennessee-Purdue said that, you know, felt that he was fouled, but he wasn't fouled based on the shot itself. He was fouled coming down after the shot, was the argument out there. If you're hit on the release, to me, that's much more of a foul than if you are hit after the ball is let go. So to me, that was the correct call in terms of allowing Guy to go and shoot the three free throws. And we'll talk with Bruce Pearl about this in hour three, about what he thought about the ending of that situation. The double dribble call, I think it's clearly wrong in terms of the letter of the law. But I'll be honest with you, I was watching that live, like many of you, and I didn't see it. And the announcers didn't see it, and the vast majority of people at home did not see that either. Because of the way that play worked itself out. I understand that an official should see it, highly trained, but I didn't see it as an egregious miss. It is interesting, as my buddy Cousin Sal from Lock It In said, that there were no officiating controversies in the WWE, but there have been a lot of officiating controversies in the NCAA tournament and the NFL, which is very funny in and of itself. If you ever watch pro wrestling very much, there is often officiating controversies, and we didn't necessarily have any in WWE last night, but we had a ton in college basketball. And so I think the call was correctly made on the three-point shot. I think probably the double dribble call should have been made, but I can easily see why it was missed. I don't see that miss as egregious given the scenario and the circumstances at play. Having said that, my God, Virginia is one of the luckiest teams we have ever seen. If they go on and win a championship, they were insanely fortunate to get to overtime against Purdue, down three. An intentional miss on a free throw that leads to an incredible pass and a shot at the buzzer to put the game into overtime. And Saturday night, Auburn is up four. Kyle Guy comes down and drains a really, really difficult three from the corner. Then they get a miss from Jared Harper, which hasn't gotten that much attention, but I don't believe Jared Harper had missed a free throw in the entire NCAA tournament so far. They get a miss there, which gives UVA the opportunity to even attempt a three for the win. Otherwise, it would have been attempting a three for the tie, and Auburn probably would have fouled intentionally again. Auburn has, and we saw this with UVA too, the whistle is swallowed to such an extent in the second half that neither team is near the bonus. And so, as a result, you know, you end up with the scenario where you have intentional fouls to give, and Auburn is able to foul a couple of times. You saw UVA have to foul several times to put Auburn on the line, and just a wild ending. And I want to go ahead and bring the crew in. We are going to talk with Dan Wetzel in the next segment. So he is with us. He got through airport security, so he's going to join us in the next segment. But I want to bring in Dub in particular first. Because you are an Auburn fan, what was your takeaway down the stretch of that game?
Well, look, it obviously was a tough call at the end. And by the book, by the letter of the law, it is a foul. But it seemed to me like throughout the game, especially the middle part of the game, they kind of let the two teams play. So when I'm watching a game and with the referees, I just want it to be consistent start to finish. And it seemed like towards the end, the whistles were blowing a little bit more than they were throughout the game prior to that.
What about the missed double dribble?
I mean, there's two referees. You can see pictures. They're all over Twitter. There's two referees looking right at the play. I mean, that's one of the more basic rules in the game of basketball. And if you're a referee in the Final Four, you're supposed to be, you know, the cream of the crop, the best. And if you miss that one, it's, you know, it's pretty inexcusable in my opinion.
It is. It is a tough miss in general to not be able to catch that. But yeah, it is. I don't know. So what is your assessment? Do you see all the Auburn fans who ran out and started immediately trying to roll Toomer's corner?
Oh, I have seen all the videos of Auburn fans, and one of them involves my roommate.
Oh, he did. He thought the game was over?
I don't know if you saw the video of the fan in Minneapolis pouring a beer on his head in celebration.
Oh, I did see that. Like that was your roommate?
I live with that man.
No way.
I swear.
Wow.
So he didn't realize that the game was, like, he didn't see the foul call?
Yeah, he, like a lot of us. I mean, I was watching at a bar, and you know, for about 2 or 3 seconds, I thought we won. I thought we were going to the final, but obviously we weren't. But he was so deep into a celebration, he had not realized quite yet that there was a foul called.
All right, so I want to bring in the rest of the crew. I want your opinions on. I gave you mine. I said I think the and look, I'm a lot of times very tough on officials. I thought the call was correctly made on the 3-point attempt. That was a foul. I thought it was more than a foul. It was very similar, eerily similar, almost to the end of the Purdue Tennessee game. If people were watching that game. The difference is the Auburn play was, to me, more of a foul because Kyle Guy got hit on the shot itself. To me, there's a difference between getting hit on the shot itself and the way that everybody kicks their legs nowadays, almost Reggie Miller style. If you get hit after you let the ball go, to me, that is much less of a foul, unless it's like egregious, like somebody just runs through you. But, you know, if you go back and watch those plays and still in slow-mo, that to me is intriguing in and of itself. So I think the right call made on the Kyle Guy play, especially because he's a great three-point shooter, and he might well have made the shot if he hadn't gotten hit. That was an incredible look that they got with 1.5 seconds left or 2 points. I can't even remember exactly how much time was left on the clock. Again, it was eerily similar to the end of Tennessee-Purdue. The missed double dribble, I understand. I didn't see it. Like, if it, to me, and this is a little bit maybe ridiculous of the way I think, but I think of myself as a reasonable fan watching a game, and if I see a call and I can clearly tell in real time, oh my God, that's a foul or that's a situation. How do you miss that? I missed the double dribble. So it doesn't shock me that officials would miss that as well. Danny G, what's your breakdown there?
Yeah, I would have to agree with you on it being a foul. And to Charles Barkley's credit, he also admitted that it was a foul this time. I mean, Carson Edwards, he did kick his leg out a little bit. Wasn't the case with Guy. He couldn't come down after the shot.
Well, he got hit during the shot.
Right.
To me, that's a foul. That's a call that should be made.
Because that changes the trajectory of the shot. And in this case, he was bumped as the shot was going off. So I get that. The double dribble, though, that sucks big time for Auburn fans and anybody who had Auburn in that game, because I know that we don't see that right away. And Ernie Johnson was saying, yeah, you know, if it was up to us, we wouldn't have noticed that either. But we're not referees and we don't get paid to be referees. The referee was right there looking right at it. And the other thing I don't think a lot of people are talking about, Auburn pulled a Duke. They had too many fouls left to give at the end of the game there. It wound up hurting them, just like when Michigan State literally ran away from Duke at the very end of that game.
Yeah, I disagree completely there. I think that helped Auburn.
Well,
I think
Auburn was trying to foul Guy on that double dribble. If the ball would have had to been shot up from half court.
Yeah, Ty Jerome was the player, I think, that they fouled. That was the second foul there, who got away with the double dribble. But yeah, maybe a little bit. But the reason why they were even in that situation was because they were trying to take advantage of their extra fouls. I mean, I think that actually helped Auburn, because otherwise they would have inbounded the ball with 5.5 or 6 seconds or whatever it was and been able to get up the court and get a shot. They would have been running in full speed. To me, I have the same question that I have for the inbound play that I did at the end of Tennessee Purdue. How do you let a, and again, I didn't go back and look at the play design, so I think maybe you give credit to Tony Bennett for this, but how do you let a top 3-point shooter get a pass that allows them to get a shot off that's that good of a look with 1.5 seconds left? To me, wouldn't you say, okay, we're not going to allow a pass to allow a 3-point look with a guy? I mean, that was a really good look they got off that inbounds pass. I don't understand how a guy gets that open. I would like to watch that again. I felt the same way on the Carson Edwards play against Tennessee that Purdue got fouled on. That to me was really kind of wild. All right, when we come back, well, does anybody disagree with the call? Eddie Garcia, do you disagree with the call, or do you think that was the right call on the 3-point shot?
I mean, I don't know. I guess I'd have to say I kind of disagree. I think if you're going to make a foul call that's going to have such a major impact on the game in the final seconds, he better really hit the guy. You know what I mean? I don't know. I in real time, I thought it was a bad call.
What about you, Roberto?
Yeah, I agree with Eddie. I feel like he shouldn't have made the call. I hate when games end that way with the official.
It's amazing the ice water, so to speak, in the veins is a cliche, but for Kyle Guy in a dome trying to shoot your team into the title game to step up and drain all 3 free throws as perfectly as he did was pretty wild. I gave out Kyle Guy at 9-1 as the most outstanding player in the NCAA tournament. And that is pretty I feel really good about that bet as we head in for that game against Texas Tech tonight.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis. Weeknights at 11 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Pacific on Fox Sports Radio and the iHeartRadio app.
Live from the Geico Outkick Studios, where 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance. Visit geico.com for a free rate quote. Brought to you by TrueCar. When it comes to selling or trading in your car, you need to make good choices. And with TrueCar, you've got a star on your roster. So when you're ready to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar. True cash offer not available in all areas. Bruce Pearl, Auburn men's basketball coach, joins us now. Coach, how many times have you watched the final minute of the game?
I watched it twice. I watched the game once, and I watched the last minute twice.
And when you watch that last minute, is there anything that you would change from your perspective and what you guys did down the stretch?
Yeah, I might have, with fouls in my pocket, I might have fouled before the first three. You know, Clay, here's the deal. Guy made a big three inside of 30 seconds. I mean, I don't know, like 15, 20 seconds. And maybe a foul defending before he gets it. I don't know where one could have been had, because basically they set a couple back picks for him. He got a very tough exit to the corner, and he stuck a big shot. That got it to one. And then Jared Harper got fouled. He makes 1 out of 2. He had made 18 free throws in a row prior to the miss in tournament play. But that gives us just a 2-point lead. And then maybe in using the 2 fouls that we did have, could we have taken another second or two off the clock before he fouled? You know, maybe. But the point is, they made a couple of plays at the very end of the game. We made some amazing plays in the last 5 minutes of the game to go on a 14-0 run to take a 2-point lead. So it was a great game. It was just a great college basketball game.
Did you notice the double dribble in real time watching the game take place?
No, I didn't. And it was just, you know, because Bryce had made a really good defensive play. And I couldn't tell whether Bryce had deflected the ball or whether or not Jerome had lost the ball. You couldn't tell. I couldn't.
How good is Virginia?
Well, they're really good. Their issue is depth, you know, and I thought that we could – I told the guys, if we could hang in there in the first 15 minutes of each, maybe 10, I said, you know, we got chance, because we're going to play 9 guys, they're going to play 6. And depth could be a problem for them tonight, you know, against Texas Tech. But they're really good. And they are clearly, like Auburn, Auburn, Virginia, Texas Tech, Michigan, the teams in the Final Four this year, what incredible runs all those teams have have had overcoming lots of different obstacles.
Do you still feel like you're a little bit of a fog over how fast this process all goes? I know it's your first Final Four. The game ends in such a crazy fashion. I can't even imagine what your emotions are like. Do you still feel like you're still kind of caught up in all those moments, or have you had time to finally breathe a little bit?
Well, I mean, you know, it's yesterday was a blur. You know, I haven't slept in 2 days because of my own second guessing of what I could have done better in the scout, how I could have got my kids better shots, you know, just everything. But I will tell you, you shift gears fast. And I'm going to take Wednesday off. I am. I'm taking the whole day off. Other than that, I'm getting back to work.
I know that it's frustrating to lose in the Final Four, but when you look back over the run that you guys got on at Auburn, how much gratification, how much excitement, how overall is the story for you about 2018-19 Auburn?
Well, we made history. Bottom line is we made history, and we with the road to the Final Four could not have been more challenging when we slayed three giants in North Carolina. And Kansas and Kentucky, and the only one seed left in the tournament we get in the first game of the Final Four. Not picked to win it. Nobody on the All-American list. No first-team All-Conference players. But you put this coaching staff and these kids together and some really talented kids. But mutts. We're just mutts. It tells you that anybody can accomplish anything when we could be playing for a championship.
We're talking to Auburn men's basketball coach Bruce Pearl. Coach, there's a lot of coaching drama out there in the universe right now. How much attention do you pay to it?
Well, you don't pay a ton of attention to it because you're locked in to what you're doing. It's amazing how, you know, what's going on in the world. Just, you know, and I pay attention to that kind of stuff. And, you know, I'm going to get, you know, obviously get caught up. I realize that, right now, it's kind of out of whack. We had three or four guys lose their job in the SEC, Clay, that were been in an NCAA tournament in the last couple of years. I mean, Billy Kennedy at Texas A&M was in two Sweet 16s in the last 4 years, and he got fired because he wasn't winning enough. And I understand to the victor go the spoils, and it is disconcerting sometimes. So.
When you look at the overall talent, you just mentioned it in the SEC, and I got a stat for you that I think you'll hear and you'll be like, wow. And you just mentioned how good Billy Kennedy did, and he just got replaced by Buzz Williams. But the SEC had 7 of its 14 teams play in the NCAA tournament this year, just added Buzz Williams, Eric Musselman, and Nate Oates as head coaches. How good a talent from a coaching perspective is the SEC right now?
Could be the best in the country. And it's not a knock on any of the school or conference. Just let it be a compliment to the collection of coaches. It just means more, and it just got harder.
Coach, I appreciate you making time for us. Said you haven't slept in 2 days. Good luck trying to get some rest on Wednesday and enjoy the game tonight as best you can.
Should be a great game tonight, Clay. It's always, always great to be with you, my friend.
Appreciate that. That's Auburn men's basketball coach Bruce Pearl making time for us early this morning to hop on, given the wackiness and the wildness of how that game just came to a close. It feels like it just came to a close, even though it was Saturday night.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick the Coverage with Clay Travis weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
This is one of the most sent stories we've ever received in the Animal Thunderdome, and I want to make sure nobody misses this one because it may define karma. Cue the music, boys.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I'm just glad I was there.
Boys and girls.
I thought he thought I was like this ginormous piece of chicken.
Dying time's here.
I have a boa constrictor stuck to my face.
Sam, you have a what?
This is Animal Thunderdome.
We go to the fertile plains of Africa. Danny G, take it away.
Yeah, this is a pretty insane story. A suspected rhino poacher has been eaten by lions after being trampled to death by an elephant in South Africa.
Big win for the animals here. So we got a rhino poacher suspected.
Yep.
He is trampled to death by elephants.
Correct.
And then eaten by lions.
After the lions had finished, only his skull and trousers were left. South African National Parks report. The man's family were alerted by his accomplices, who said he had been killed by an elephant while they were in Kruger National Park to poach rhino. Oh, boy. Rangers on foot, accompanied by members of the KNP Air Wing, flew over the area. Initially, they failed to find the body, but after being given further information by four of the man's accomplices, they searched again and found what little was left. Indications found at the scene suggested that a pride of lions devoured his remains, leaving only a human skull and a pair of pants, SANP said. That is karma at its finest.
So I read this story and I thought it felt like so much karma. Do you think it's possible that these guys who were also poachers killed him and fed him to lions and then said, this is what happened to him? Because it seems like the karma on this is just off the charts, right? You got a rhino poacher who gets killed by an elephant and then eaten by lions. But it almost is too perfect of a story.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to have to do some more investigating to
all
find out for sure.
All that's left is a skull and some pants. Like, how would you know if foul play was involved or not? This seems like in the same way that, like, you know, we always have these stories about somebody getting eaten by a crocodile. Like, if you shot someone and then they got eaten by a crocodile, what are the odds that somebody would be able to tell that you shot them first? I mean, I know that a great, you know, forensic scientist or whatever who goes back over the autopsy could find this and be able to tell you that.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that would be a difficult thing to do, probably especially when you have a situation like this where it seems kind of open and shut.
I mean, it's just too perfect, but then again, I guess it would be the perfect crime, right? So we'll keep our eye on this, and if any more news comes out.
I want more details, basically, out of this story, because it's just so perfect. I mean, it is everywhere. It's one of the most shared Animal Thunderdome stories we've ever gotten.
We'll keep tracking it. There's another one here. The Burmese python.
Oh, I saw this. I'm terrified by it. This is a 17-foot Burmese python they found in the Everglades.
Yes, I'll tweet a picture of this out and tag you, at Clay Travis. Scientists caught a female python in the Florida Everglades. More than 17 feet long, it weighs 140 pounds and contains 73 developing eggs.
Ugh.
The snake is the largest python ever removed from the Big Cypress National Preserve. This is just west of Miami in South Florida. Here's a fact that really surprised me. This article says that state wildlife officials estimate there's as many as 100,000 pythons living in the swamps outside of Miami.
100,000. I mean, a 17-foot python is just, I mean, have we had a person killed by a python in Florida yet?
That's a good question. We'll look that up. You would think the answer has to be yes, right?
Yeah, but I mean, in the wild, like where you're just, you know, like going through in a canoe. And next thing you know, because I don't think people think of the danger of like a huge python getting them. But the picture I saw of that 17-foot snake, I mean, if there are over 100,000 of them now, they've basically just taken over, as far as I'm concerned, in South Florida. Like, and the theory on this, and again, it may not be 100% accurate, but was that Hurricane Andrew, which I believe happened in 1992, which was so devastating, one of the most devastating hurricanes to ever hit South Florida, wiped, like, freed so many boa constrictors and pythons and everything else, and they just got into the wild in mass numbers then, and since that time have bred. Now, I'm sure the other aspect here is people can never keep their snakes. They always escape, which is why I don't trust people who have snakes. Like, there isn't a single person who's ever had a pet snake that hasn't had the snake get out of the cage and just kind of disappear in the house. So I know a lot of them have kind of gotten away in general, but that's the theory on how so many of them got out, and now they're just running like crazy all over the place, which is just utterly terrifying. There's even videos of alligators and pythons like having Mortal Kombat fights to the death. True Animal Thunderdome.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com and within the iHeartRadio app.
We are indeed here in the Geico Outkick Studios, joined now by Evan Daniels, who broke the story about UCLA's pursuit of Rick Barnes, the latest UCLA pursuit, I should say. Evan, what's the latest on that story so far as you know?
Yeah, Clay, I know that the two sides spoke last night. What exactly came out of that meeting, I don't think we know yet. I think that they'll probably meet again this morning. But that's kind of the latest. Obviously, UCLA has serious interest in Rick Barnes, and everything that I've been told, he has interest back. So I guess we'll see how it plays out. I think we'll probably know some stuff today.
What do you think UCLA might be offering him? There are reports that they offered $8 million a year to John Calipari. Rick Barnes around the top 10 highest paid, second highest paid, I believe, right now in the SEC. How much do you think UCLA might be putting on the table for him? Any idea?
No, I don't have an idea. And that's a great question. And I actually saw that you tweeted about this, and I've been wondering the same thing. Like, one of the things about pursuing Rick Barnes that surprised me was when I figured out what his buyout was.
Yeah.
And basically what his buyout in his contract says that it's basically $1 million a year from today till 2024. So it's $5 to $6 million. And I mean, this is why the Jamie Dixon deal fell apart. His was $8 million. There's really not that much. There's not a big difference between the $5 and $8 million, especially if it's a guy that you want. And I know that's a roundabout way to not answer your question, but I don't know what type of offer he would be getting, but I would imagine it's pretty substantial.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's a good point as well. So people can say, well, it's $2 or $3 million less, and certainly that's true. But if you are UCLA and you balk at $8 million for Jamie Dixon, and let's say it's five, let's take the lower number, and let's say you're going to have to pay $5 million plus whatever the contract is for Rick Barnes, it's not like from a financial perspective, UCLA would be in that much of a different position.
That's true. And I think the thing that we often forget about, too, is you got to pay taxes on that money. So it's really a little bit more than the $8 million or the $5 to $6 million that Rick Barnes will have in his contract. And you said he's pretty highly paid. This is a guy that's got an annual salary of $3.2 million. So, I mean, if UCLA is coming in and trying to get him, I can't imagine they're offering him less than $4 million.
So how did they get here? I mean, because we got a lot of people waking up on the West Coast with us right now. We're talking to Evan Daniels. He's the man who broke the story about UCLA's pursuit of Rick Barnes. I'm reading Gary Parrish's story at CBS, and he said, this is the most disastrous coaching search ever. You offer less money to John Calipari to come to live in a much more expensive city and a much more difficult job, relatively speaking, given the situations. How do we kind of take us through this process? Because I think there's a lot of people like, how in the world is this job still open? How many people have they tried to reach out to? And how do they end up on Rick Barnes?
Yeah, I actually read that story from Gary early this morning, and I agree with much of it. I mean, they got rid of Steve Alford on December 31st, and they went and offered John Calipari, who was their top target, less money to come across the country. And obviously UCLA is a tremendous school, but look, I lived in Lexington. I know what the cost of living is compared to Manhattan Beach.
Yes.
I thought about moving there at one point. It's like five times.
Yeah.
If you make $100,000 in Lexington, you're going to make $520,000 in Manhattan Beach.
Yes.
Massive difference. So that was a swing and a miss, and honestly an embarrassment and a black eye. And I think Calipari did what probably you or I or anybody else would have done in that situation. He used that interest to parlay it into more money. So then they turned to Mick Cronin and Jamie Dixon. I think they opted to pursue Jamie Dixon. I don't know if they did or didn't know about the buyout, but that's an obvious thing that you need to know before you're going to pursue a candidate. The thought that you could get a buyout down, I mean, why would TCU let him go? They wouldn't. They're not going to lower an $8 million buyout. The only way you're going to lower an $8 million buyout is because you don't want that coach anymore. But Jamie Dixon has done a tremendous job at TCU, so they're not lowering that buyout. And I think that kind of leads us to where we are now with Rick Barnes.
Rick Barnes is going to be 65, I believe, at the start of next year's college basketball season. let's say that UCLA is able to hire him. The reaction of UCLA fans is what?
Oh, I would guess that they are happy from a standpoint as he's a good basketball coach. I think that their fan base was going to get this big, sexy hire. And I'm not saying Rick isn't a sexy hire. Rick's just coming across the country from Tennessee, hasn't been on the West Coast in a little bit. I think that they thought they were, that fan base thought they were getting a coach like Calipari or Billy Donovan. And if you go to their message boards, it's pretty quickly to see that type of talk. I think there'd be a section of that fan base would be happy. I think the other section of that fan base would be like, well, I thought we were getting John Calipari. I thought we were getting a Jay Wright. And that's not a knock on Rick Barnes. He's a tremendous coach. But the expectations of that fan base in this coaching search have seemed to be off.
Why would Rick Barnes leave Tennessee and go to UCLA? Other than money, which is always an answer. And look, if UCLA is saying we'll pay you $5 or $6 million a year, we'll make you the third highest paid coach in college basketball. Okay, like I can see an argument where you look purely at dollars and cents. Other than money, why would he go?
I think that's probably the biggest question here, Clay. You know, obviously that UCLA program is historic, and they've had a facelift on their facilities. It's a top 10 program in terms of wins. I think that at UCLA you can probably recruit a higher caliber player consistently. But I think this whole thing surprised me because, one, the job that he's done at Tennessee has been absolutely tremendous. He's been able to kind of put his imprint on that program. But let's look at it this way. They made the Sweet 16 this past season. They had a tremendous year, won 31 games. There's a really good chance that they're going to lose a Jordan Bone, who's already declared for the draft and told me specifically that he has every intention of staying in that draft. Good chance they lose Grant Williams, lose Admiral Schofield. You're going to likely lose your top three players. I mean, you've got some guys coming in, one of the best point guards in the country, Josiah James. But there's still going to be a lot to replace. So we have to wonder if that factors in here at all.
Yeah, and I am fascinated by this in general, too. Let's say that Rick Barnes leaves. He goes to UCLA. If you are Tennessee athletic director Phil Fulmer, who has a great relationship with Bruce Pearl, isn't his first call to pick up the phone and ask Bruce Pearl if he's interested in leaving Auburn and coming back to Knoxville, or do you think he would go somewhere else? How good of a job would Tennessee be if UCLA hires away Rick Barnes?
Well, Tennessee is still a good job, but you and I both know that call to Bruce Pearl is not happening. Now, would he crush it there? We've already seen it. But that call is not happening. I would imagine that call wouldn't be allowed there.
So where would Tennessee go?
I do think there's a great list of guys that are doing some really good things at mid-major schools, and some even locally, or fairly local. Matt McMahon at Murray State would have to be a name that pops up in this type of search. Wes Miller from UNC Greensboro would have to be a name that pops up in that type of search, but there's no name that I would say, hey, this has to be the guy. But there's plenty of good up and coming mid-major coaches that I personally would look at because I think they're tremendous coaches and doing a great job. Obviously, Matt McMahon recruited Ja Morant and helped develop him into what's going to be a top three pick. But that's probably the route I would likely see them going.
What do you think that we're talking to Evan Daniels? He broke the news that UCLA is pursuing Rick Barnes. LA Times UCLA beat writer said two things. They said that they had talked to Rick Barnes and Lon Kruger, and that Rick Barnes would take the job if it was offered. Lon Kruger says he did not interview, did not talk to UCLA. Do you think that UCLA is currently talking to anybody else? And do you think this ends up happening if you were setting odds right now and having to take bets? What do you think the most likely outcome is here?
My understanding is this is who they want, and he's the front runner. So I would be surprised if they are currently talking to anyone else. In terms of do I think this happens. I talked to multiple sources last night, and I'm kind of getting I'm getting different feedback. There is a portion that thinks this deal is close and nearly done, and another portion that thinks this could be a ploy to get more money. In terms of odds from him leaving, I would not be shocked if 6 o'clock today, Rick Barnes wasn't the head coach at Tennessee anymore. But I also wouldn't be shocked if at 6 o'clock today, it comes out that he got an extension.
If UCLA doesn't get Rick Barnes, let's say that Rick Barnes uses this to go the John Calipari route. He's 65. He gets a 5-year extension that basically says, hey, you're going to be at Tennessee until you retire. He comes out and says a statement, I love Tennessee. I'm going to be here forever. I got more money for my assistant coaches. I appreciate the support, whatever, which certainly is one angle that he could go. What the world does UCLA do at that point if they have been publicly spurned in such a way by at least 3 different guys, right? That would then be, and we'll count the spurning as you blew it with Jamie Dixon over the $8 million buyout, but you theoretically maybe get a lifetime deal for John Calipari at Kentucky, maybe a lifetime deal for Rick Barnes at Tennessee, and then obviously you don't have the wherewithal to be able to get Jamie Dixon deal done. What in the world do they do then?
It's already been a somewhat embarrassing search. At that point, they've got to go get a good basketball coach. And there are plenty of names out there, Clay, that they haven't really done too much with. Like, why didn't they pursue Keldon Sampson? A name we never hear about in a search like this would be Ed Cooley, a tremendous basketball coach at Providence. Kevin Keats would be a name that I would have considered. Mike Hopkins from Washington, he's an L.A. guy. He's turned around Washington very quickly in the same league. Like, there's some obvious names that would be great candidates in college choices at UCLA. I'm a little baffled about not going after some of them. It appears that they don't really know what their next move is. I think that's been pretty proven in this coaching search so far.
Yeah, it's wild because they did such an incredible job sweeping in and grabbing Chip Kelly when Florida really thought they had Chip Kelly signed for football, right? And then Guerrero travels across the country, makes his pitch, brings back Chip Kelly. It's a home run hire, and it looked so well put together. They fire Jim Mora. It looks like such a perfectly organized and executed plot to get a great West Coast coach. And now they've been fumbling. You know, you said, and we talked about, they fired Steve Alford on December 31st. That's back in 18, right? So they have all of January, all February, all of March. And now we're into April. And you mentioned those guys that they could look at. Why would they not go after Bruce Pearl? Am I crazy here? Like, you got a guy in the Final Four. Pearl is like a Barnum and Bailey, you know, like a circus ringmaster. We just had him on the show. If I had a choice, if I was Dan Guerrero, between Rick Barnes or Bruce Pearl, purely for who fits at UCLA and who will bring in interest and attention, I don't see that as a very difficult call. I would rather have Pearl. Now, you can say that's crazy, but why would they not have looked at Pearl too?
Well, one, I agree with you on Bruce Pearl. I think he's a tremendous coach. He brings energy. I mean, what he's done with that Auburn program has been incredible and taking them, obviously, to heights they've never reached before. I think we're in a little bit of a weird space in college basketball right now because of the FBI investigation. And granted, he himself hasn't been implemented on anything. He has had an assistant. And you have to wonder how that factors into hiring processes, because I know that there's a number of assistant coaches that just because they were at schools that came up in this investigation that other schools wouldn't touch. And I think athletic directors are very cognizant of that. And I would imagine that factors in not only with him, but plenty of others, even though he hasn't been directly implicated in that deal.
All right, so we're talking to Evan Daniels, doing great work on the UCLA basketball search, reported that Rick Barnes has become their focal point. Is there any way, like, so we don't know what's going to happen with the Lakers, but Luke Walton seems like he might get fired. Is there any way, and Earl Watson is sitting around out there too, that UCLA just throws their hands up and says, let's just get a Bruin. Let's get a UCLA guy. And Luke Walton or Earl Watson could end up being focal points on this search before all is said and done?
I guess it's possible, but it's honestly, based on this search so far and what I've been told, I don't think that's a route that they end up going. I mean, if they were going to hire Earl Watson, they could have done that 3 months ago.
Yeah.
They could have done that during the season. And same goes with a Fred Hoiberg. I also, Clay, I don't get this firing midseason thing. Like, why are you going to fire Steve Alford on December 31st? Let him play out the year. Who knows? One, who knows what's going to happen? I understand the fans were fed up. They want to get rid of him, this, that, and the other. But it clearly didn't give them any advantage to fire him on December 31st. I mean, really, the only thing it did was they lost a recruit or two quicker than maybe they would have if they had waited until March. That did not make sense to me, and it's something that I really don't think makes a ton of sense in college basketball. There's no reason to fire him on December 31st if you're not going to go out and hire Fred Hoiberg, who was available at that time.
I appreciate you waking up early with us. You said you think something gets resolved with Rick Barnes today. What time frame? You think this is something we know? You said 6, I think, earlier during the interview. Is this something that stretches on another day, or do you think by noon we know what's going to happen here?
I was just kind of throwing out the 6 o'clock. I think it's going to move quickly. I would guess that we know today. I don't think it's definitive that we know something today. But obviously, I know that the two sides spoke last night, and I think they're going to speak again this morning, and I guess we'll see what happens.
Do you know where Rick Barnes is right now? I know he got the Naismith Award for Coach of the Year. Is he still in Minneapolis, or is he back in Knoxville, or do you have any idea where his geographic location is right now?
I believe he is back in Knoxville. He was in Minneapolis, and I think he's back in Knoxville.
Because there were some reports that he met face-to-face with Phil Fulmer, I think, last night on campus, right?
I had heard that they had met, but I left it at talk because I know they talked. I'm not 100% positive that they were in person.
Evan, I know you got a billion things you're chasing right now. Fantastic stuff. Good luck chasing this story. How can people follow you if they're really intrigued on this UCLA coaching search?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at Evan Daniels. College basketball stuff over at FS1 and recruiting over on 24/7 Sports. That's where you can read the initial story over on 24/7 Sports about Rick Barnes and UCLA, and we'll be tracking it throughout.
Outstanding. Follow at Evan Daniels on Twitter. Appreciate my man.